hell that I was in, I'd do anything to be better.
I thought like a lunatic.
You kind of just have like that little bit of hope that it will get better.
You're gonna make it.
This began my surrender.
I am a witness of my own growth.
It's a life beyond your wildest dreams, and I just have to say, it works if you work it.
My story, that's what I share.
You're listening to Far From Finished, a weekly podcast where we share new, real-life stories of hope and triumph, told by the people who live them. Today's story comes to us from...
My name's Caitlin. My sobriety date is March 4th, 2016. I grew up in Hamilton Township, New Jersey, which is like right outside of Trenton. My parents didn't really have a lot of money when I was growing up, but I never knew that. They kind of hid it very well. And we had a very nice life. We had a house. My sister and I each had our own rooms. My parents were married. They're still married, which is pretty cool because not too many people can say that these days, that their parents stayed together. We had a house. We had a dog. We had a front and a backyard. We had like a fence. We had a little tree in the front yard. We called it the ice cream tree. And my childhood was great. I never wanted for anything. They gave me the best that they could, and everything was fantastic. I know some people grew up in alcoholic families or they were abused as children, and none of that happened to me. I was just like this squeaky clean little, you know, suburban girl. And then I turned 4, and nothing in my family changed, but I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, and it was very hard for me to... to reconcile that. I was raised not in a religious family, but I was raised as a Lutheran, and my dad's a Catholic. My grandma is like half Jewish, so my religious upbringing was a little confusing. But I decided at 4 years old, when I was diagnosed with diabetes, that like there's no God. There can't be a God. And why would someone do this to me? I felt bad about myself. And I thought that I had done it, because if there's no God, like, I must have done something to deserve this. So I remember, like, my mom keeps telling me that I was a happy kid and I was really funny and I made everybody laugh, but I don't remember that. I just remember feeling, like, this very deep sense of not fitting in, not belonging. And, like, from a very, very young age, my nickname when I was 2 was Katie No-No. Like, I always was way too curious about the wrong things. My very first shoplifting experience was when I was 2. I stole peanuts from the ShopRite. Sorry, ShopRite. And, like, it was weird. I remember asking my mom if I was adopted, and, like, I know that my sister is your kid, but am I your kid? And I didn't like myself. I didn't like anything about myself. It didn't matter what other people said about me. Like, they told me I was great, and they told me I was funny, and they told me I was smart, but I didn't recognize that in myself. So growing up, I did really well in school. I didn't do homework. I never did homework. I would lose my homework in my backpack or not hand it in or pretend that I lost it, but really I knew where it was, and I just didn't want to do it. I would put in, like, the least effort possible to get by. But I did really, really well on tests, and I did really well on the SATs. So I was able to kind of get through school and get into the colleges that I wanted to get into. Backing up a little bit, I tried my first drink when I was 12, because, like, my parents didn't drink when I was growing up. There was no alcohol in the house, and I didn't really know what it was. But in the DARE program in 5th grade, they told us all about drugs and alcohol and what they did and how they ruined everybody's life. And I already didn't really like myself, so I was drawn to that kind of lifestyle. And it seemed really appealing to me. Not so much to homelessness and dereliction and all that comes with that, but mostly just not feeling the way that I felt, because I remember them saying, like, specifically about heroin in particular, this stuff is so good it'll ruin your life. Like, you'll just want that and nothing else for the rest of your life. And I was like, okay, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do that. My life will be great, and then I'll die. And so I decided to start with drinking because it was available. My grandpa had left a beer in the fridge when I was probably 10 when he left it there, and I was 12 when I drank it. So you can imagine how that tasted and how my head felt afterward. Like, it didn't feel good, didn't taste good, didn't smell good. It was expired. It had been sitting in my closet because I was hiding it from my parents. And I think my mom finally found it there when I went to college. So it stayed in the closet. I didn't touch it from age 12 to 17. And I didn't like it, but I liked what it did to me. So like any good little alcoholic or addict, like I kind of switched. I didn't drink or do anything else for a little bit. A few other things happened in the middle, but like I started smoking pot when I was 15 with my best friend. And what led up to me doing that was, again, just not liking how I felt. When I was 14, I met this guy, and he was very depressed. I was very depressed, and we kind of clicked, and we dated for a while, and then he eventually ended up committing suicide in November, like right after I turned 15. I turned 15 in September. He killed himself in November, and I didn't know what to do with it, but I knew I didn't like it, and I just cried for months, just all day, all night, couldn't stop. And it was terrible. Like I think back on that time and it was awful. And I blamed myself for not being able to help him. And I blamed him for not helping himself. And I just wanted to kind of drown that feeling. And I knew that he had been an alcoholic, basically. He would call me sometimes, like walking down the railroad tracks, completely wasted. And he seemed happier than he did when he was sober. So taking that into account, I started drinking with my friends. We got drunk like every weekend at her house, at her boyfriend's house, wherever we were. And that led to like me feeling okay with smoking pot because I was drinking and then I felt fine. So I decided I'll smoke some pot and I felt fine. And I didn't end up liking it. It gave me my very first panic attack, also when I was 15. So my run with marijuana was very short, but I had a panic attack when I was 15, and I ended up in the hospital because I thought I was having a heart attack, which was absolutely terrifying. My heart was going so fast, like it was skipping beats. I was paranoid. Like, I don't know why it happened. Maybe it was because of the antidepressants I was on at the time, or that I'd smoked a cigarette before, but I guess it doesn't really matter. But I had this panic attack and I ended up in the hospital. And they gave me so much Valium to finally slow my heart down. But they had to call my parents first because I was 15 and in New Jersey, I don't know if it's a national thing, but in New Jersey, you have to be 16 to be treated at the hospital. So that was it for pot for me. That was the last, well, no, I smoked pot one more time after that. But that was the last time for several years that I smoked. And I still, like, I didn't like the way I felt and I didn't want to be inside of myself, and I started drinking more, and I started drinking by myself, but again, I didn't like what it did to me. Like, I liked how I felt because I didn't feel like myself, but the room started spinning, and I didn't like that, and I didn't like throwing up. My very, very first driving experience, I didn't even have my learner's permit yet, but I was less drunk than my best friend, so we decided that it was safer for me to drive home than for her to drive home because it was a straight line. And I blew through like three traffic lights and stop signs, whatever. And somehow we made it home alive. But like that was my first experience driving a car. My first experience with basically everything was some sort of intoxicated. And I was really depressed. I'd been sexually assaulted in the meantime by my friend, like the different friend's brother. And I just had some things happen that weren't so great, and I didn't deal with them. I wouldn't say proper, like, I don't know if there is a proper way to deal with those things when you're 15. But I went to therapy, and I took the medication, and I didn't like it, so I self-medicated. And I know it's the same for a lot of people. Like, I constantly hear, I didn't like myself, I didn't like how I felt, I wanted to get out of myself, and that's exactly what it was. I just drowned all my feelings. And when I was 16, the same friend who I had been drinking with, who I smoked pot with, she offered me a Percocet. And she basically told me, like, you don't want to do this. And I was like, no, you're going to give it to me. Like, just give me the pill. I don't care. So she relented, and I took it. And I remember it was her and her boyfriend and my boyfriend at the time and me, and we were all doing it. And I had chastised her in the past for doing Percocet. Like, you're going to get addicted to this stuff. It's going to happen. There's nothing you can do about it. And then I saw how euphoric it made her, and I wanted it. Like, I wanted to feel that way. So I took it, and that's exactly how I felt. Like, it was like I'd been holding my breath my entire life, and I could finally take a deep breath. Like, I could inhale. And it was great, and it made me exactly who I wanted to be. It made me more outgoing. I was really shy as a kid. I had emotional problems. I didn't have too many friends. But I thought it made me funny. I thought it made me smart. I thought it made me all these things that, like, I am underneath, but I had no idea. So it brought those things out of me. And basically right from the start, it wasn't a daily thing right from the start, but it was give me as much as possible, as quickly as possible, as often as possible. And her gift to me at my high school graduation was Percocet, because she knew that's the only thing I wanted. So I got into colleges. Like I said, I did pretty okay in school. I got into a few different colleges, every single one I applied to, actually. And I ended up going to a school in North Jersey for equestrian stuff, like for horses, because that was like my main thing. That was my only ambition in life, was to train horses and ride horses and be involved in some sort of barn management. So I went to college for horses, and I did okay there. I didn't like it too much. I was used to not so much of a like high class environment, I guess. I'm used to suburbia, and these girls had like millionaire parents, and they owned their own horses, and they were very financially fortunate, which is not to say that I wasn't, but like they had way more money than me. And I felt really uncomfortable and really out of place, and it was a really small school. Like, it had 1,200 students, I think maybe that many, probably less. And I kind of latched on to like one or two people and stuck with them and refused to come out of my shell to anybody else. And then when I was 18 or 19, I can't remember exactly which age I was, but I developed basically a life-threatening allergy to horses, so I can't be around them anymore. I can't go in the barn. I had to quit my job. I had to switch schools, which was a blessing in disguise, really, because I was not happy there. When I was 18 and I was at that school, I had another boyfriend get run over by a truck, and he passed away. And I was in North Jersey and he was in South Jersey, and I dealt with his death by doing drugs. Like, I drowned myself. And it was hard, and I drew really far into myself. I wouldn't talk to my roommate. I wouldn't come out of my room. I wouldn't go to class. And I met another guy. There's always a guy. Like, there's still a guy. But at least this time it's healthy. And so I met this guy, and I had the horse allergy, and I moved back into my parents' house because I was switching schools to go back to school down near them, at a school in Lawrenceville called Ryder. I don't know if anyone's heard of it. Probably not. It's really small too, but slightly bigger than like 1,200 students. And I had really liked my psychology class in high school because like I wanted to figure out what the heck was wrong with me. So I decided to be a psych major. And that actually went really, really well. I fell in love with it. I love how people's minds work. I love figuring out why people do what they do. And I decided to use that for myself and figure out like what the fuck is wrong with me, because clearly there was something wrong with me. I remember calling my sister in the middle of the night when she first started college and I was still in high school, like sobbing my eyes out, like, what is wrong with me? Please tell me. And she was a psych student too, so I thought she could figure it out for me, and she couldn't, so I took it upon myself. In the meantime though, I moved right back down the street from that same friend who had given me the Percocet in the first place, and she had moved on to, let's say, bigger and better drugs at that point. So So I followed suit. And that's how I got into oxycodone. And I really thought it was just like a fun thing at first because it made me feel good and it made me laugh and it made me talkative. And I had a lot more fun hanging out with this girl that I really didn't have too much in common with. So it did something for me that I couldn't. And it was tough because like that was the only thing I wanted to do. And I started to draw away from my family and I started to draw away from the guy I was seeing. And he was an alcoholic as well. I seemed to have a type. So he was a really very serious alcoholic, and I can call him an alcoholic because he identifies as one. He's not sober today, as far as I know, but he is aware that he's an alcoholic. And I use his alcoholism and his emotional and mental and sexual abuse as like a reason to just keep going because I thought that's as good as it was going to get for me. I remember lying in my bed with him one night thinking, this is your life now. You just have to accept it. This is it. No one is going to love you if you leave him. Like, just, this is your life now. This is what you have to do. Just deal with it. And so that's what I tried to do. And to do that, like, to accept the situation that I was in, I had to cover it up somehow. So I started using, I started selling to support my habit. And my friend decided that she was going to quit, and she stopped talking to me, which at the time, like, I was just really upset about it. I thought she abandoned me. I didn't understand, and now I understand that she just needed to do what was right for herself so that she could get out of her situation. And I don't know where she is today. I hope she's doing okay, but it took me a long time to get over that resentment. And so I was basically alone from then on in my youth for like a long time. The only people I hung out with were people that used. That's all we did. And I didn't recognize it as a problem. Like I was stealing thousands and thousands of dollars from my job because I didn't make enough money to support my habit, even with the selling drugs. And I didn't see a problem with it. I just thought, this is what I have to do. This is what I have to do. That's what I did. And I finally quit that job. I got a new job where I made a little bit more money and I met some really nice people. And I got myself out of that relationship after about 3 years. I think it was almost exactly 3 years, actually. Started dating someone else immediately. But I figured, oh, it's okay. Like, he knows that I have an addiction problem and he knows what he's getting himself into. Hey, can I stay at your house for 2 weeks because I need a place to stay? My parents were under the impression that I was staying in a dorm room in my college and I was staying with this guy. So I couldn't go home until the semester was over. So I moved in with this coworker that I just met and I said I was going to stay there for 2 weeks and I moved out. Let's see, I moved in like November 2011. I moved out in April of 2015. So it was a little longer than I anticipated being there. And I took him as a hostage. In the meantime, like I was using more and more. I was driving down from Central Jersey to South Jersey, like by Camden, every single day. And I was working a full-time job and going to school full-time. And I don't know how I balanced it all. Like, I thought I was queen of the universe because I can balance a hardcore drug addiction, full-time school, and a full-time job. And they gave me more responsibilities at work, and I started dating the guy that I lived with, which I feel like is kind of backward for most situations. Most people start dating and then move in together, but I guess I'm not a conventional human being. I took him hostage, and he was an unintentional enabler. Like, he had no idea that he was enabling me. He would let me borrow his car if I didn't have mine. He would let me borrow money if I couldn't find my wallet or if I had overdrawn my account. He would let me know like when our bank statements had been posted so that I could get my paycheck and go pick up because he knew that that's the only thing that made me happy. And I still feel like really terrible for having done everything that I did to him. And I know that's something that I have to work on. but it was, you know, it was lonely because I only hung out with people that used and my boyfriend, and I went to work and I went to school and I came home. I graduated college with a bachelor's somehow and like a 3.8 in 2012 because I loved what I was doing in school, and I used the drugs to kind of concentrate, I guess, even though I was falling asleep in class. Like, I thought I couldn't do it without them because I had started getting sick if I didn't take them. And I didn't know what that was. I remember lying on my couch, twitching, thinking, like, what is going on? Because no one told me that there's physical withdrawal from opiates. I had to figure that shit out by myself. And I just thought I was getting really sick, and I thought that, like, my diabetes wasn't under control. I'd been diagnosed with, like, a digestive problem, so I thought that might be part of it. And then I was roaming around on the internet, and someone on the internet was like, no, you're dope sick. Like, you need drugs to not feel that way. So I decided that I was never going to feel that way again, and I was just going to use every single day for the rest of my life. And it brought me right back to being in fifth grade and having the DARE program and listening to the cop point at the heroin and be like, this is so good, it'll ruin your life. And he's right. At that point, I hadn't moved on to heroin yet, but I knew it was basically the same thing. And I made a friend online because my boyfriend at the time had said, you know, you spend too much time by yourself. You don't do anything. You don't go out. You don't see anybody. Like, you need to make friends. So I made a friend who used, and I was his drug dealer for a while. And then we just started using together. And then my dealer went to jail. And then my other dealer went to jail. And then my other dealer ran out because all of his connects had gone to jail. I guess it was a crackdown or something. But having known that heroin was basically the same thing as oxycodone, I accepted a bag. And it felt exactly the same as it had when I took that first Percocet. Like, I felt like I could breathe, and I felt like the world wasn't crashing down around me, and I needed so much less of it to feel the same way than I did with the pills. So that happened, and it was a daily thing with heroin right from the start. I managed to make it 3 months using heroin before I started shooting up. As a diabetic, I had needles lying all around the house. Like, it was just something that I had. And for some reason, it didn't cross my mind until I got sick. And heroin gives me pneumonia. It lowers my immune system enough that, like, my lungs fill with water. And there was nothing I could do about it. Like, I thought there was nothing I could do about it. I kept going to the hospital, and I kept thinking, I'm just going to be on prednisone for the rest of my life. And again, like, it was just, this is something you need to deal with. This is your life now. Accept it. So I did. So I was in and out of the hospital. I was using in the hospital while they were treating me for the heroin that was making me sick. I was doing it in the hospital while they're trying to make me better. So I was using and using and using and getting better and getting worse. And I finally figured out that it was the heroin that was doing it to me, but I thought maybe it's because I'm just, like, sniffing it too hard. Maybe it's because it's getting in my lungs somehow. I should just start using needles and bypass the lungs, and everything will be great. So I brought some needles and some cotton balls and, like, two alcohol wipes to my friend's house, and we shot up for the first time together. And it wasn't all it was cracked up to be. Like, it didn't, I had read all sorts of things online that said, like, you're supposed to get this feeling and it's supposed to be the best feeling ever. And I felt like nothing. I just felt kind of fucked up, but not really. So I decided that I had done something wrong because clearly it's supposed to feel different than this. So I'm going to figure out which variable I missed. I considered myself a scientist, so I was going to tinker with my chemistry until I got it right. And I remember exactly where I was, exactly what I was doing the first time I shot up and I felt it. And I think that's a feeling that's never going to go away. Like, the memory of that is never going to leave me. And it's disquieting. Like, it makes me uncomfortable because part of me still feels like that's the best I'm ever going to feel. And I know that's untrue. Like, there are so many better feelings than heroin, but it's tough. I was sitting in the bathroom with my back against the wall, with my back against the door, to keep everybody else from getting in. And I did it, and I sat there, and, like, I thought I was going to die. I really, really thought I was going to die, and I kind of fell over to the side a little bit. My head felt funny. And I was like, whoa, I'm going to do that again. So I did it again, and then I did it again for a year and a half. And I thought that was okay. And, like, I'd started doing some scummy things to get money, and I started not paying my rent because drugs were more important, and I started ignoring my boyfriend and hanging out with this other friend way more. Like, I would stay over his house and just do drugs all night, or we'd go see a movie and do drugs in the bathroom, and I would just completely ignore this poor guy that loved me so much. And eventually he found out that I was shooting up, and he, like, he wasn't okay with me using, but he was really, really not okay with me using needles. And he asked me to quit. I said, okay, I'll quit. But the way he worded it was that you can't use drugs anymore in my house. So I took that to mean you can use drugs, just don't use them in my house. So I would go other places to go use. And at this time I was in grad school, and I was in an internship for school counseling. And that was a mistake in and of itself, because I went into the program because it was easy and I had a high enough GPA that I didn't have to take the GREs to get in. So I was in this internship, and I find out that I already knew I didn't like children, but, like, I really don't like children. And I don't know why I was there. And I had this, like, little private bathroom in my office. So I would use in the bathroom in my office and then try to counsel little kids on how to be better people. And I thought that that was not exactly congruent with what I should be doing. So I dropped out. Like, I just stopped going. I told my supervisor at my internship that I had had some problems and that I didn't want to do it anymore. And she was like, okay, I'll just come back next time and we'll figure something out. And I said, okay. And I haven't talked to her since then. That was in, I guess that was in April of 2015. And that's when it got really bad. Like, I just abandoned everything else. I stopped showing up to work. I stopped showing up for my family. My boyfriend kicked me out because he had to. There was no other alternative for him. Like, I was tearing his life apart. And so he said, you know, you have to leave, and I'm going to tell your parents that this is going on, because they had no idea. And I decided that I was going to tell them before he could. He had no intention of actually telling them. He just knew that if he told me that, I would have to tell them. Or they find out eventually when I move back in and, like, I was passed out in my bed or whatever. So I moved back in with them. They very kindly let me back into their house and said, you know, if you get treatment, if you try to get better, we'll let you live here. And I just didn't want to do it. I thought I was going to figure it out. I thought I was going to figure out how to successfully use and hide it from everybody and have this good life and not do anything shitty to anybody, but still also do heroin, which, as it turns out, does not work. I came to find through my trial and error process there. So I started going to treatment in April 2015. Since that time, I've been in 11 different instances of treatment. Not all of them were inpatient, but I've been in short term, in detox, in, like, a 14-day mini rehab, in a 28-day program. I was in IOP. I had a partial hospitalization. I was in traditional outpatient. I had a psychiatrist. I had a Suboxone doctor. I tried having, like, a licensed alcohol and drug counselor, and I couldn't figure out how to do it. Like, I couldn't figure out how to use and how to be a real person at the same time and have, like, a successful life, because that's just not possible for me. Like, I'm sure there are unicorns out there who can do it, but I am not one of them. So I started seeing the Suboxone doctor, and I was selling my medication to get heroin and using 3 days of the week and then taking a couple days off so I could pass my drug tests. And at that point, my parents had control of my bank account and they gave me like this card that you can't get cash back from. So I would buy gift cards with the card, sell the gift cards for cash, and buy drugs. Like, I was doing whatever I had to. I had no possessions to sell, so I sold myself. And I lost myself. I don't know if I ever had myself to begin with, but whatever shred of self I had, it was gone. I had no self-respect, no dignity. I lost like 50 pounds in less than 6 months. And I was down to about 108. I'm 5'4", so 108 is like pretty skinny for me. I was still a size 3, but you could see all my ribs. I stopped eating. I stopped talking to people, and I just, like, I kept going back to detox to get people off my back. And I started going to NA meetings to get people off my back, because they said in treatment, like, some little tiny part of me figured out that I do need help. Like, I do want this to end, but I don't know how to do it. And I didn't believe anybody in the meetings about it getting better. And like doing step work and working with other people and how it doesn't have to be that way. And I just didn't understand. So I would go back into treatment so that I didn't get kicked out of my house. But I didn't want to go back to my house because I knew that my parents were there and I felt bad for stealing from them, for using in their house, for everything really. Like, they had done nothing to deserve this and I felt awful. So I had a home to go to. I just didn't want to be there. So I would sleep in my car. I would sleep at my friend's house. I would sleep, like, outside. It didn't matter. I would sleep in, like, the McDonald's parking lot in Trenton. And I would go every day. My dealer was my best friend. He was the only person that knew what was going on in my life. He knew when I went to treatment. He knew when I got out. He knew how many days it would take for me to come back. And it was really sad. Like, the GPS on my phone thought that I worked at the chicken place where I picked up drugs because I was there so much. And I still had the same job. Like, I was still working at the same job that I had started at in 2011. And I found out very recently that the only reason they didn't fire me was because they thought that if I was at least at work, I wasn't dead. Like, they knew I was alive, they knew where I was, and my manager made a case for me to corporate not to fire me because he was so concerned about me. Otherwise, like, my attendance was terrible. I called out every other day. Sometimes I just didn't show up. I would leave early. I would take hour and a half lunch breaks because I would go shoot up in the parking lot and fall asleep in my car. It just kept getting worse, and I say it kept getting worse, but, like, I kept making it worse. Every time something good would happen, I would just take it and throw it on the ground and stomp all over it. Like, I had so many opportunities to get clean and to really do the thing, but I couldn't figure out that I could do it. I thought that I was one of those, like, hopeless people that just was doomed to be a drug addict for the rest of my life. There's nothing you can do about it. Like, again, it was the same thing as when I was laying in the bed thinking about my alcoholic boyfriend. Like, this is your life. This is as good as it's going to get. You're a shitty person. You don't deserve to get better. You've done terrible things. Just accept it. And so I did. Like, I tried to figure out a way to do it. And I was in this IOP program. And I remember I graduated the IOP program high. Like, I shot up before I went in that day. They had my graduation ceremony, and I left. And I told myself I wasn't going to use every day. I was just going to do it 3 days a week, and that was going to be it. And, of course, it didn't work that way. Like, it was every single day from then on. And that was New Year's in 2016. In February 2016, it was my dad's birthday. I finally agreed to go back to detox, and I went, I think I finally went to detox like 4 days after his birthday, And I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle being in the detox. I couldn't handle not being on the drugs. I couldn't handle being on the drugs. And I think on the third, maybe fourth day of detox, I just decided, like, I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to yes them to death so I can go home, and I'm going to kill myself because there is no way out. There's absolutely no way out. There's nothing I can do. And I got out of detox on February 26th, I believe. 6 days later, overdose on behind the wheel of a moving car on purpose, because I had, in a moment of clarity, I had told my parents, hey, I want to die. And they made me go to the hospital. Like, they took me to my partial hospitalization program in the morning. The cops took me to the hospital. And I said, this is a mistake. It's like, I don't want help. So I lied to them. I said, I don't want to die. There's been a misunderstanding. I'm sorry. It was just an ideation. It's not a plan. And they told me I could leave. So I called my parents. And they didn't pick up the phone at first. And I called and I called and I called. And they finally answered. And they came to get me because I didn't have my car. Like, it was at their house. And we got to my house and they said, okay, like, you can come have dinner with us, but you can't stay here. And I fought them on it, and I cried, and I guilted them. And they stood firm. Like, they had started going to Naranon. They knew how to detach. And they knew that I couldn't stay there because I was bringing them down with me. Like, that's what I did. I just took everybody around me and threw them into the ground and lit them all on fire. So my instinctive reaction was, okay, obviously I'm going to go pick up some drugs. But also, like I said goodbye to my mom. And she started crying and I started crying and she said, wait, and I walked out. And like, I thought that was it. Like, I thought that was the last time I was going to see my mom. And so I went down to Trenton and I met my dealer, and I bought a brand new pack of needles, and I shot up on the side of the road, and I knew it wasn't just heroin, like, when I was using it. Like, it was different. It didn't look right, it didn't taste right, it didn't smell right, it didn't feel right. And I knew that before I put it in my body, and I did it anyway. So I shot up in the same place they had taken blood out of my hand in the hospital earlier that day. And my last memory is putting the car in drive, because I had texted my mom saying, I wish my life had turned out differently. I'm sorry. And she called me and she said, please come home. We can talk about this. We can figure something out. And I said, okay. I said, I'll be home in 15 minutes. If I'm not there in 15 minutes, call me back. And I had no intention of going home. So I went on the side of the road and I shot up and I put the car in drive because I figured, okay, I didn't die. I guess I'll go home now. And my next memory is waking up on the side of the road in the grass with the front of my shirt cut open and paramedics, EMTs, and cops, like, all around me. And I looked up and I couldn't really see. I wear glasses. And they're pretty strong. Like, I can't see for shit. But I looked up and I could see that the airbags on my car had gone off and, like, there was something wrong with the wheels. And what happened was, somehow passed out. Like, I guess my foot must have gotten stuck on the gas. And I got up to about 45 miles an hour before I hit the other car. I'm not sure if it was stopped. I'm not sure if it was going 25, like the speed limit. Like, I have no idea, but it was a mom and a dad and a 2-year-old. And I just slammed into the back of their car, ricocheted off it, hit a telephone pole, bounced off of that, like, broke my front axle. One of my windows was broken, but I'm not sure which one, but I know there was glass. And the car went up on 2 wheels and came down facing the wrong direction in the middle of the road. And an off-duty EMT happened to be driving by like just magically happened to be driving by and saw the whole thing happen. And once my car finally stopped, she pulled me out of the car, took my glasses off, and did CPR on me until the cops got there with the Narcan. And I woke up, like I said, with the cops, with the EMTs all around me, with the family standing there next to their car. He was taken away in an ambulance. Thankfully, no one got seriously injured. But, like, I could have killed someone. I could have killed four people that day, including myself. And so I went to the hospital because it was a motor vehicle accident, so they had to put me in, like, the cuff thing, the neck thing, whatever that is, neck brace. And I got there, and they said it was an overdose, and the cops came and charged me with a DWI and took blood. And I just, I didn't care anymore. But I made them get my cell phone out of my car so I could call my mom because I knew she would be freaking out because I didn't die. So now I have to deal with the consequences of this. And they got to the hospital almost faster than I did. Both of my parents came. And my mom was sitting next to my hospital bed. I was handcuffed to the hospital bed. And she looked at me and she said, "Is this enough? Have you had enough?" And I said, "No." Like I said, I didn't want to be part of it anymore. I didn't know how to stop, and I didn't think I could, and I didn't really want to, and I didn't want help. And she cried, and I cried, and my dad cried. I've seen my dad cry like four times in my life, and that's one of them. And it was awful. Like, some people have a very high bottom. Some people just realize that they have a problem and they get help, and I was not one of those people. Like, I had to drive myself physically into the ground and be dead before I realized that, like, this could not continue on. So I was in the ER for 8 days. They couldn't admit me to the hospital because I'm diabetic, so, like, my blood sugar wasn't regulated. So they couldn't admit me until my blood sugar was regulated. The doctors in the ER kept changing, so my blood sugar was, like, all over the goddamn place. And every single day, the social worker would come in and say, "Okay, you're going to leave tomorrow. You're going to go to psychiatric treatment." And every day, 5 p.m., she would come back in and say they said no. We went to every single psychiatric facility in New Jersey, and they all said no. They all said, "You don't have a psychological problem. You're not dual diagnosis. You're just an addict, and you need to go to rehab." And I kind of fought them on that because I knew that if I went to rehab, like, it was going to be for a while. It wasn't just going to be a detox and, like, 2 weeks of therapy, and then I would leave. And so my parents had a conversation with a psychiatrist, and they told him, or he told them, basically, like, if you find somewhere for her to go, she can go. But they weren't going to let me leave because every time they came in, they said, "Okay, do you want help now?" And I would say no. And they would say, "Okay, you get another 72 hours on suicide watch until you go to rehab." And so they found a place in North Jersey for me to go for 90 days. And I had no idea what to expect. Like, I'd kept going back to the same treatment center because they would take me because I'm diabetic. So, like, a lot of places won't take me. And they finally found some place that would, like, they encouraged me to have my insulin pumped, which is really important because I didn't, like, if I was going to give it an honest shot to try and get better, I didn't want to have to use syringes for obvious reasons. So they let me keep my insulin pump, and it seemed like an okay place. And it was either that or stay in the hospital indefinitely or go to jail, and I didn't want either of those two other options. So I agreed to go. And I agreed to go for 3 months, and I thought that was the longest time in the entire universe. Like, I'd met people with 90 days clean, and they were just my hero. Like, they had so much time. And I didn't think I was going to make it through. And honestly, like, they didn't either when I got there. My counselor at the end of my stay told me that she was really worried that I was just going to walk out of the building, walk down the hill, and no one would ever see me again. And I went in 117 pounds. I hadn't showered in probably 6 days, and I was a mess. and I had 8 days clean, and I thought that I was the shit. Like, why do you need to still put me in detox? I have 8 days. Like, I've gone through withdrawal. You can just put me in rehab and get this over with. But a little part of me knew that, like, I needed the night in detox just to get assimilated, and I needed to meet people, and I needed to give up, and not in the way that I had tried to a week earlier. And I started going to groups and participating in the groups, and I decided to give it, like, an honest, fair shot, because I had no other option. Like, I had nothing left. So I started talking to people, and I started opening up in my group sessions, and I started listening, and I started journaling, which is something that I was always kind of into, but I never really had time to after I started going to college. And I wrote every single day of that 90 days. My rehab journal is almost 600 pages long. And I wrote everything down, like every single feeling I had, every single thought I had. I took notes on the lectures we had. I took notes about boys I thought were cute. I took notes about people that I thought might be my friend after we left. All of those people, by the way, are dead now. Like, all three of the girls that I was best friends with in rehab died between Thanksgiving last year and February of this past year, which sucks. Like, this disease does not fuck around. And it will take people from you, and it tried to take me. But, like, I wanted to find out if I could do it, because if I got clean, if I got sober, and I didn't like who I was, it was always there. Like, I could always go back. And that was one of my main fears. Like, what if I stop and I hate myself? And that's really not the case at all. Like, all of those things that people told me that I was, like, that I was funny, that I was smart, that people liked me, it's all true. And I can actually see it now. So I started putting some effort into my recovery. And people would, like, make fun of me because I was so into being at rehab. Like, I got really excited, and they called me Princess Sunrise House because I was there for so long, and I loved it so much. And I left after 91 days. Ride my eyeballs out. I did not want to leave. Like, I very happily would have stayed there for the rest of my days on this earth, probably. And I went to a halfway house, and it will remain nameless because I didn't like it. It wasn't for me, but that doesn't mean it's not for everybody. So I don't want to, like, put the name out there and then have people not go there. But I was miserable. And I had taken suicide off the table as an option, so I felt really trapped. And I had started talking to this guy while I was in rehab. He left about a month before I did. Like, he came after me and left before me, but we got to be really good friends. And he was coming up to see me every weekend. Like, when we had these meetings, like alumni meetings, and I was allowed to go. So he went to those, and we hung out for a little bit. So I called him, and I cried on the phone to him and said, I hate it. I don't want to be here. And he said, you know, is it going to get better? And I said, no, it's not. So he said, okay, you know, what are you going to do? So I found the Oxford House website online. And I hadn't heard, like, sparkling reviews about Oxford Houses, but I found a really good one. And I went for an interview on Thursday. And I moved into the house on Friday. Had I not moved into the house on Friday, I would have been kicked out of the halfway house anyway, because there was a disagreement with the staff there about whether or not I should be there. And they said, you know, we're not a hotel. It doesn't matter how much money you paid to be here. You got to go. So I left. And the last thing my counselor said to me before I moved into this Oxford house was, don't get high on the way home. And in past treatment centers, someone has told me, oh, you're going to get high, you're going to relapse. And I took that as, like, a death sentence. I took that to mean, yes, I'm going to. And for the first time in my life, I thought, no, I'm not. Even if it's just to spite you, I'm not going to do it. And so this poor kid that I met in rehab drove all the way down to the middle of New Jersey from, like, Newark, basically, to to come get me and move me into this Oxford house because my parents had gone on vacation. Like, they decided that they loved me and they wanted to help me as much as they could, but they needed to be, like, they needed to continue on with their lives. And if I was going to do the right thing, then I was going to do the right thing. And they didn't have to worry about it, really. So I got into the Oxford house and I moved in. And it's like, it's a really nice house. And it has really wonderful women. There are 8 of us. Right now the house capacity is 8. And I started to try to, like, live again. And I'd never really started trying to live in the first place, so it was all brand new. And my first job out of rehab was working in a bar and restaurant. Like, I worked right next to the bar. And it was not encouraged of me to do that because, like, it's a bar. It's not a great place for me to be and be surrounded by alcohol and possibly drugs. But, you know, it was humbling. It was a shitty job. I was a hostess, and I worked for $10 an hour for, like, 20 hours a week, and I couldn't pay my own rent, so my dad paid it for me, thank God. But it taught me, you know, it taught me a lot about how to be a person. And I started going to meetings. I went to my first meeting before I moved into the house. That was a Friday night meeting at 5 p.m., and that group became my home group. And they have 12 meetings a week there, and I think probably if they didn't have that many meetings a week, it wouldn't be my home group because I need to see the same people all the time, and I need them to know what's going on with me. And, like, I'm a very private person, so seeing the same people all the time is really comforting. And I went to an AA meeting because that's where the guy that I liked went. If he had brought me to an NA meeting, I probably would be going to NA right now. But that's just not how it worked out. And so, like, that became my home group, and I started going to meetings, and I started working at this job, and I started living my life. And since then, it's really only gotten better. Like, I'm on my second sponsor because my first sponsor and I were just, like, really good friends, and I didn't feel like it was appropriate to go through the step work with her, so I switched sponsors. And I know a lot of people say this, but I have the best sponsor in the world. I don't care what anybody says. Mine's the best. And she has brought me through to step 6. Like, I'm working on step 6 right now in the 12 steps. And having been through, you know, a few of the 12 steps, like, I can sit with myself now. I can be alone in my room and not feel lonely. I can just be alone. And that's brand new to me. I've never been just content by myself. I've always needed something or someone to be there to distract me from whatever was going on in my head. And I don't mind anymore. Like, it's fine. I prefer to be alone sometimes. And I was at a meeting the other day and someone said that there's a difference between isolation and solitude. And, like, I need my me time. And I understand that now. Like, before, I wanted someone to come over to me and ask me how I was doing so I could tell them to go away. And I was so lonely all the time. I was just, it was horrible. Like, I felt very alone and very lonely, and now I don't. And it's basically like a result of going to AA and doing the right thing. And sobriety has offered me lots of things. Like, I say sober now because I'm in AA, but, like, I'm clean, if that's the word you want to use. And it's brought me some really great things. Like, I got a new job on, like, 2 days before my 1-year anniversary. I got this new job, and I work for a very public figure doing a really cool thing, and I make a pretty decent amount of money, and I don't spend it on drugs, which is just a freaking magic trick to me. Like, that doesn't happen. I'm the kind of person who sits up till 3:04 in the morning, hitting refresh on my bank page, waiting for the check to hit so I can go. And, like, I don't worry about money right now. I pay my own rent. My dad doesn't have to worry about that anymore. I lost my license because of the DWI. Like, I did get charged with that, obviously. And I got my license back in May, like the end of April, beginning of May. And the picture on my license, you can tell that I'm trying to like contain my joy and I can't, which I think is pretty cool because most of my license pictures have just been like, ugh, okay, get this over with. But, like, I look really happy because I am. And I bought a car, and it's the first car that's ever been in my own name. Like, my dad would always buy the car for me, and I'd have to pay him back or something. But this is my car, and I pay my own rent, and I have my own job, and I pay all my own bills. And I have all of these responsibilities and all of these things that I never wanted, but now they're like the only things that I want. They're the only things I won't give up in my life. And I did start dating that guy that I met in rehab, which is not something I would recommend. Let me just put that out there. Like, rehab romance is not the way to go. But it's worked out for us because we didn't do what everybody else does. Like, we didn't just start hanging out every day and go use together and hope it works out. Like, everything was very slow, and I've made friends very slowly. And I've realized that doing things slowly rather than just jumping into them is definitely the way to go. And like, I go and speak at rehabs a lot because I don't really have an Alcoholics Anonymous story. So I feel kind of uncomfortable going to other meetings and sharing my story because like there's a lot of drugs. There's not too much alcohol. But if I go to a detox, if I go to a rehab, I can potentially help someone. And really, that's what I want to do. And I don't want to do it for a job because I have a job. Like, I don't need another job. And I don't want to do something that I really like without getting paid and have it turn into something being paid because it'll lose its charm. And, like, the point of the whole thing is to help someone else, right? So I try to do that. And I try to do the right thing, and I'm still in the Oxford House. I've been here just over a year. And, like, I'm looking for apartments to move into because I can almost afford one by myself. But there's a small part of me that just never wants to leave here. Because my roommate and the other girls in this house are my absolute best friends in the entire world. I would do anything for them. And, like, I found real happiness rather than just like synthetic euphoria. And I didn't know that was possible. So I'm coming up on a year and a half, and I'm really excited for that because my record before this was 21 days in a locked facility, like magnetically locked doors, need a key card to get out. And it's not always easy. It's not. I almost got out of my car this morning and in a fit of road rage, like screamed at some guy in his face because like I still have feelings and sometimes they're still very difficult to deal with, but I'm learning how to do it. And it's been, you know, it's been fun. It's been hard. It's been painful. It's been fantastic. It's been joyous. And like, I never, ever, ever want to go back to where I was. Like, there's not one part of me that truly wants that life back because it wasn't a life. Like, I wasn't living. I was hardly even existing. I was in my room alone with my Netflix on and a needle. And that was it. Like, I didn't go out and have fun. I didn't go out and see friends. I didn't go out to eat. I didn't eat. I didn't do anything. And I thought that's what I wanted. Like, I really thought that's what I wanted to do with my life and my time, and I was just going to die a junkie. But, like, I don't have to. And I don't ever have to use again, and I don't ever have to feel that way again, and I don't have to be alone anymore. And, like, for anyone trying to get clean or trying to get sober or trying to do it and they think that they can't, like, I'm living proof that you can. It's going to sound kind of cheesy, but like when I was on step two, it was already done for me. Like I realized that there were too many coincidences to be coincidences, you know? And I I started believing in something, and that started me in believing that I could do it, because like I didn't have to do it alone. It's hard to think about because I wasn't there. I was there before it and I was there after it, but I wasn't there during it. So it's hard to really like grasp how heavy it is sometimes. Like it was really excruciating for everyone around me, but I wasn't there. You can go to meetings and not use or not drink or whatever, but that's really not, it's not enough. You know, like connecting with people and identifying with them and feeling like you're a part of something has been the most important thing for me, because I felt alone all my life. And if I just went to meetings, if I didn't put my whole heart into it, if I didn't really look at myself from the inside out, like if I wasn't doing step work, I don't know if I'd be using, but I would certainly be unhappy. So like getting involved, it doesn't, I don't think it matters like what you do. You join Smart Recovery, you join NA, you join AA, you join HA, you join CA, you join Overeaters Anonymous, Sex and Love, whatever Anonymous, like whatever it is, just get involved and it gets better.